Geopolitical struggles and humanitarian crises take center stage at the Russia-Africa summit.
Our very hope is that as the African leaders go to the Russia-Africa summit, they can actually be able to have a much more sound conversation about the Black Sea Grain Deal, amongst other things that, of course, will be negotiated there.
Plus, a whistleblower tells Congress the U.S. is concealing a multi-decades program that captures UFOs.
These sightings are not rare or isolated. They are routine. Military aircrew and commercial pilots, trained observers whose lives depend on accurate identification, are frequently witnessing these phenomena.
And Irish singer-songwriter Sinead O'Connor has died at the age of 56. Today is Thursday, July 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. African leaders, including South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, are heading to St. Petersburg this week for the second Russia-Africa summit as an isolated Moscow looks to shore up its influence in a key region. Analysts tell VOA that high on the agenda will be President Vladimir Putin's nixing of an arrangement that allowed Ukrainian grain to reach foreign markets. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
It's a busy week for diplomacy in Africa, with U.S. Deputy Treasury Secretary Brian Nelson, China's top diplomat Wang Yi, and Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba all on visits to the continent. Meanwhile, African officials are going to Russia, where Putin will be under pressure to reassure them after he terminated a deal allowing safe passage of Ukrainian grain exports earlier this month, a move criticized by the African Union Commission as something that could negatively affect food security, especially in Africa. African governments have been riled by the move, with one senior Kenyan official saying the axing of the agreement is a stab in the back. Wandile Silobo, chief economist of the Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa, said the decision not to renew the deal has already caused an increase in global food prices, which could hurt parts of Africa.
Our very hope is that as the African leaders go to the Russia-Africa summit, they can actually be able to have a much more sound conversation about the Black Sea Grain Deal, amongst other things that, of course, will be negotiated there, so that this can go back on the table and the exports can go.
Earlier this week, Putin himself sought to reassure African countries, relations with which have become increasingly important given Russia's isolation by the West since its invasion of Ukraine last year. Many African countries have been hesitant to take sides in the conflict. In a statement, Putin promised that Russia could replace the Ukrainian grain itself, both on a commercial and free-of-charge basis. Cameron Hudson, an analyst with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, said Putin is likely to use the St. Petersburg meeting, which starts Thursday, to appeal to African leaders' direct needs.
So obviously he's trying to win back some friends from his exit from the grain deal, and also show that he has the power to kind of cut bilateral deals with African countries that put them, frankly, more in his need, which is exactly the position that he wants to be in.
Analysts have noted that Russia has an outsized influence in Africa comparative to its trade and investment clout. At the first Russia-Africa summit in 2019, Putin vowed to double trade with Africa to $40 billion over 5 years. Instead, it has been sitting at about $18 billion a year, compared to China's record $282 billion worth of trade with Africa. Despite its relatively minor economic clout, Moscow is keen to use the summit to project political heft, says Dennis Reaver, a researcher for the Institute of Security Studies in South Africa.
Russia has very cleverly learned realized some of the problems that exist between Western, say, the European Union and the U.S. and Africa, and has positioned itself in a way to separate itself from these traditional partners.
While the summit aims to position Russia as a global player, Russian media reported that fewer than half of the African countries attending are sending their heads of state. Analysts also said the issue of the Wagner Group, the mercenary group that recently attempted an aborted mutiny in Russia and which has operations in several African nations, will likely be raised on the summit sidelines. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
NATO said on Wednesday it was stepping up surveillance of the Black Sea region as it condemned Russia's exit from the deal that assured the safe passage of ships carrying Ukrainian grain. Meanwhile, there's been a surge of wounded soldiers coinciding with the major Ukraine counteroffensive launched in June to try to recapture its land from Russian forces. Surgeons at the Mekhnikov Hospital, one of Ukraine's biggest, are busier now than perhaps in any other time since Russia invaded 17 months ago. We get details now from Associated Press correspondent Lawrence Brooks.
The soldiers come with bandaged limbs soaked in blood, faces blackened with shrapnel fragments, and stunned eyes fixed on the ceiling, frozen in shock. Lately, they've been coming with ever greater frequency. A serviceman with a gaping thigh wound shrieks in pain as medical workers move him to a surgical gurney to have his leg amputated. By day, the Mekhnikov Hospital functions as normal, treating cancer patients and others with chronic diseases. But as evening comes, the pace of activity in the trauma room picks up, with wounded soldiers in desperate need of surgery arriving nearly every 15 minutes. The injured arrive, many unconscious, and surgeons operate. The soldiers are then sent off to recover elsewhere to create space for the next nightly deluge. The hospital's chief doctor says, "It's a very difficult situation, but the fact that 95% of our soldiers recover is a better indicator. What else can you dream about? We try to do everything so that everyone who gets into trouble is sure to recover." I'm Lawrence Brooks.
A group of soldiers claimed on national television in Niger Wednesday that President Mohamed Bazoum had been removed from power. They say they put an end to the government over the African country's deteriorating security. The United States joined world leaders in calling for the release of Bazoum, who was being held inside the country's presidential palace by members of his presidential guard. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan released a statement that the U.S. is deeply concerned about developments in Niger. And U.N. spokesman Stéphane Dujarric said Secretary General Antonio Guterres had spoken to President Bazoum on Wednesday afternoon.
The Secretary General is following closely the situation in Niger. He condemns in the strongest terms any efforts to seize power by force and to undermine democratic governance, peace, and stability in Niger. The Secretary General calls on all actors involved to exercise restraint and ensure the protection of constitutional order. The United Nations stands by the government and people of Niger.
The soldiers said all of the country's institutions had been suspended and security forces were managing the situation while urging external partners not to interfere. VOA's Carol Van Dam spoke to Michael Shurkin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, for analysis on this evolving situation.
President Bazoum has been one of the most effective leaders in the area, if not the most effective leaders. He's somebody who, by many standards, has been doing all the right things in terms of trying to deal with the country's vast problems and working effectively with Niger's many Western security partners, including France and the United States. A coup would, and from that point of view, also, he's an ideal partner for the West because he's been effective and also because he's democratically elected. So he's got a lot of legitimacy. He's exactly the kind of person that outside of the Western partners want to be working with. A coup removes from the region a democratically elected and effective civilian official, replacing it with, first of all, a necessary period of uncertainty as the Nigerians have to figure out what to do and make all the next steps, which is in and of itself a very bad thing given the fact that Niger is already basically dealing with several crises. This is a very bad time to be going through this kind of phase of uncertainty. And also, it's a huge blow to the West, which has really been turning to Niger and to Bazoum as sort of like its last effort to try to shape events in the Sahel, as the Sahel otherwise has been swirling down the drain.
So if this democratically elected president is, like you say, doing the right things from the outside world and the international community can see, why is this even happening?
We don't really know why it's happening, and the reasons could be many. This could be about pay. This could be because Bazoum simply snubbed socially the characters who are leading the putsch. This could be because, I don't know, because they want tacos served every Tuesday in the cafeteria. We don't really know. But just sort of looking at what happened in Mali and Burkina Faso next door, we see that there's legitimate frustration on the part of many people for the pace of change, the pace of improvement, the extent to things are going their way. And part of the challenge in a country like Niger is even if you have the best people doing the best things and doing all the right things, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to prevail, or it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to prevail anytime soon, given the nature of the kinds of problems that Niger has. In that context, a lot of Nigerian, just like Burkinabe and Malian, are frustrated. And it's easy to imagine how, and I believe this was the case in Mali and Burkina Faso, how some senior officer in the Nigerian government could, out of frustration, think either, I could do better, so I'm going to do this. Or, huh, I see an opportunity here, then, and I could take advantage of this situation to seize power for myself.
So it could be an individual general's
personal ambition,
desire for power. Yeah.
Or, I mean, but they'll never be couched as such. Nobody ever takes over, and says that I did it for my own personal power. You know, if they succeed, they're going to couch their actions in terms of saving their country. That's what they're going to say. I don't mean to say that there won't be any truth to that. It could be some combination. It could really be purely out of some misguided sense of patriotism that they need to intervene to save the country from the abyss. We really just don't know.
Michael Shurkin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam. Hunter Biden's plea deal on two tax charges fell apart Wednesday after the federal judge hearing his case expressed concern over a related agreement. Associated Press correspondent Ed Donahue has more on the latest legal woes of the president's son.
A federal judge in Delaware has questions about the terms of the agreement. Hunter Biden pleaded not guilty to two tax charges. The judge has issues with a separate felony charge, possessing a firearm in 2018 as a drug user. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre points out Hunter Biden is a private citizen.
This case was handled independently, as all of you know, by the Justice Department under the leadership of a prosecutor appointed by the former president, President Trump.
Republicans like House Speaker Kevin McCarthy think Hunter Biden is getting preferential treatment.
We have to find the end. If the justice system is fair to all Americans and not one system for the Biden Inc. family and another for America.
Under the plea deal, Hunter Biden's gun case would be wiped from the record. Otherwise, the felony charge carries 10 years in prison. Ed Donahue, Washington.
The United States government absolutely has recovered extraterrestrial craft, according to a former member of a Defense Department task force that investigated what are known as unidentified anomalous phenomena, or UAP. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington. This was part of sensational testimony during a congressional hearing on Wednesday.
David Grush at Wednesday's hearing of a House subcommittee said he knows the exact locations of alien craft and has provided that information to the intelligence community's inspector general. Grush told lawmakers the U.S. government also possesses evidence of non-human biologics. He was one of three former military officers appearing before the committee. Ryan Graves, a former Navy fighter pilot, said he was among many of his colleagues who routinely encountered unidentified flying objects.
These sightings are not rare or isolated. They are routine. Military aircrew and commercial pilots, trained observers whose lives depend on accurate identification, are frequently witnessing these phenomena.
Several members of the committee said they want to make public more information about such encounters and are accusing military and intelligence officials of stonewalling their efforts. UAP are a national security issue the president takes seriously, according to John Kirby, a former Navy admiral and National Security Council spokesman. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen, one of the world's longest-serving leaders, said Wednesday he will resign in 3 weeks and hand power over to his eldest son, Hun Manai, after almost four decades of hardline rule. Israel's highest court said Wednesday it will hear legal challenges to a divisive new law that weakens its power, putting the country's top justices in the position of defending their own independence amid a political crisis that is unleashed the country's biggest protests in history. A fire blazed on a cargo ship with nearly 3,000 vehicles on board located off the Dutch coast. Several crew members were forced to jump overboard after the fire began Tuesday night. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. The European Space Agency's Aeolus satellite has been in orbit for 5 years, 2 years past its planned mission of monitoring wind activity on Earth. With its fuel supply nearly exhausted, the spacecraft, affected by Earth's gravity, atmosphere, and solar activity, began falling from its normal orbit on June 19th. Instead of letting it deorbit naturally, the space agency is performing a first-of-its-kind assisted re-entry of the defunct spacecraft. ESA's intervention began on July 24th with a series of maneuvers to steer its descent. Final commands will be sent to the satellite on July 28th. When it reaches 80 kilometers above Earth, it's expected most of the spacecraft will begin to burn up as it travels through the atmosphere. Any remaining debris has been targeted to fall in a remote area of the Atlantic Ocean. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. The UN says more than 100,000 South Sudanese living in Sudan have returned to their home country since Sudan's conflict broke out in April. That number is growing rapidly, with an average of 1,000 more arriving each day. Correspondent Henry Wilkins reports from Renk, South Sudan.
The town of Renk in northern South Sudan is accessible only by a long boat ride or plane from the capital, Juba. But it's connected to Sudan's capital, Khartoum, by a paved road. Since Sudan's war erupted in April, the food and goods that used to arrive along the road have stopped coming. South Sudanese who fled to Sudan years ago for refuge from their own country's civil war arrive instead. They are in desperate need of help. Francis James Hakim says his journey here was perilous as they passed checkpoints run by the Sudanese army and the paramilitary group the army is at war with, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Hakim says on the way, we found the Rapid Support Forces, RSF. They checked and searched us thoroughly, he says. If you have ID, no problem. But if you tell them you're Sudanese, it's a problem for sure. He says the only solution is bribery. If you have enough money, they let you go. Many returnees like Hakim identify as Sudanese because they have lived there most or sometimes all of their lives, but do not have citizenship. Hakim left South Sudan when he was a toddler. More than 100,000 returnees have arrived in South Sudan, mostly through Renk, since Sudan's conflict began. But having escaped the fighting, they are faced with a new set of problems. Lan Aik is a community leader among the returnees. He says he came from Khartoum, but the problem facing us now, instead of insecurity, is that we do not have enough to eat. It's the rainy season, he adds, and everyone here is living without proper shelter. The UN says roughly 1,000 people are arriving to Renk each day, with no end in sight to Sudan's war. Kiganzi Niakato is with the UN's World Food Programme in South Sudan.
We do expect more as we hear that the conflict is intensifying, increasingly spreading across South Kordofan and other parts of Sudan. The rains have not helped. They're preparing for cholera. Measles cases have already started being reported.
Although the returnees are citizens, the South Sudanese government does not want them to stay in Renk. They are being relocated to other parts of the country where, because they are citizens, they will have access to the labour market and have at least some hope of supporting themselves. Most say they want to get out of Renk, which is starved of resources to support them. Teresa William is another returnee. She says the authorities need to clear the returnee site so the community can live peacefully. The conditions are very challenging. People are living outside and they're suffering. You can see the reality, she adds. Yet, as the UN and local authorities struggle to relocate the huge numbers arriving, it's unclear how long she will have to remain in the limbo of Renk. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Renk, South Sudan.
The Haitian women's football team made its debut Saturday in the FIFA Women's World Cup football tournament. They lost to England, but to their fans, they are still winners. For VOA Creole, Valerio St. Louis and Gentil Gustin Jr. have more from Brisbane, Australia, in this report, narrated by Sandra Lemaire.
A retaken penalty by Georgia Stanway gave England the win over Haiti, which made its historic debut in the FIFA Women's World Cup football tournament. In a post-game conference, England coach Serena Wiegman admitted that it was a difficult opener for the European champions. English forward Chloe Kelly agreed.
They were fantastic, very, very, very athletic team, tidy on the ball, and they're a good side. You know, no one can be underestimated in this tournament. There's unbelievable teams and teams that we've not used to coming up against.
On the Haitian side, defensive player Tabitha Joseph told VOA that her team learned from the loss.
We should have made more passes, taken shots on goal at the right time. We need to take shots when the opportunity arises. I think for the upcoming games, we will work on that so we can win the next game.
VOA asked Haitian star forward Nerilia Mondésir how the team is feeling after the loss.
I think we are disappointed. That's it. We are bummed about the result. But I think we work hard. We did some positive things. So we are going to focus, accept our disappointment, and move forward.
Fans of the team were on hand. Despite the loss, they said they were proud.
They did what they could do to hold on. I'm very proud of them.
The superstar of the Haitian national team, Melchie Dumornay, says she feels satisfied but also disappointed because Haiti did not win the game.
It's teamwork. Together we're strong and we'll move forward together.
The team goes up against China on Friday. Valerio Saint-Louis and Gentil Augustin Jr. in Brisbane, Australia. Sandra Lemaire, VOA News.
Irish musician Sinead O'Connor has died at the age of 56, according to her family. Details on cause of death have not been given. Associated Press Entertainment correspondent Margie Laureletta has a look at her career.
Sinead O'Connor, best known for the 1990 song Nothing Compares to You, was an unlikely pop star. She shaved her head, tore up a photo of Pope John Paul II on Saturday Night Live, feuded with Frank Sinatra over the Star Spangled Banner, became a priestess, and later converted to Islam. O'Connor struggled with mental health issues and quit music several times. She said in a 2007 AP interview, despite being constantly criticized, she could not stay away from music.
My friends and my family began to say to me, well, you know, I shouldn't really let that stop me from being creative in some way, you know.
I'm Archie Zaraletta.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, we thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be safe and have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The humanitarian needs in Syria remain great. That's why working out a cross-border agreement to resume aid shipments is critical. The Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad's announcement to allow UN aid deliveries through Bab al-Hawa acknowledges the need for cross-border assistance, noted U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas Greenfield. But it includes unacceptable restrictions that would hinder relief and put aid workers at risk. Additionally, the regime's permission is only for 6 months, half the minimally necessary period recommended by the Secretary General. The Assad regime has a record of impeding UN humanitarian activities in Syria. The regime's unacceptable conditions and demands are consistent with that troubling record. For this reason, the United States has joined other major donors in making clear that any cross-border access arrangement must include 5 key elements, declared Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
The UN should be allowed to engage with all parties on the ground, consistent with how it delivers assistance around the world. The UN should be able to continue to operate response hubs outside regime-held areas. And the regime should not interfere with access arrangements between the UN and local authorities in non-regime-held areas.
Access should be granted for as long as possible and must not lapse in the middle of winter, continued Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
Guaranteed access is essential to providing the predictability and the efficiency needed by donors, UN partners, and the Syrian people. Given the overwhelming and persistent humanitarian needs in northwest Syria, there is no justification for short-term ad hoc access guarantees.
The UN should maintain its ability to determine assistance allocation based solely on needs and consistent with the principles of neutrality and impartiality. And finally, any arrangement must maintain the cross-border monitoring operation originally established under Resolution 2165 and avoid new reporting requirements for local partners or beneficiaries. More than 62,000 trucks full of life-saving aid have crossed into Syria since the Council unanimously supported Resolution 2165 in 2014. And yet the humanitarian crisis has never been more dire. 12 years of war and this year's earthquakes have pushed the Syrian people to the brink. Given Assad's shameful record, the Security Council must remain deeply engaged on humanitarian matters in Syria, urged Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. The United States will never waver in its support for the needs of the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.